Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 30, Kitchen Questions. Hey everybody, welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, and thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that helps aspiring home cooks grow their skills and confidence in the kitchen so they can start cooking up memories with family and friends. Wow, that's a mouthful. I sure have a long tagline. I'm going to have to think about that in the future. But hey, thanks so much for being here. And today I have a kind of a fun episode. It's episode number 30 of the show. I don't think that's really a milestone or anything, but it's a nice even number. So I had some questions I've gathered up from listeners that some questions about cooking, some questions about me or the show that I thought it might be kind of fun to answer in this episode. So we're going to do that today. A couple of quick items of housekeeping before we get into the questions, though. I just want to mention that if you've gone and left me a rating on iTunes or a review, such as Roller Derby Dave did recently on iTunes, I really appreciate it. That's wonderful. It really does help the show get noticed by more people on iTunes, at least. And of course, if you tell your friends or other folks around you about the show, if you get something valuable out of it, if you enjoy it and you tell other people about it, that's actually even better. So I really appreciate that. If you have any questions or comments, as always, you can send me an email to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. And of course, you can track me down on social media. Easiest way to get me is on Twitter at TKC Podcast, but you can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. I've even got an Instagram account at Kitchen Counter Podcast. So there's ways you can find me if you have questions or comments. If you want to send in a question for a future show or a show idea, which I've got a few that I've received that I'm going to talk about today as well. I'd love to hear from you. So let's do this. Let's answer some questions from listeners. All right. I have taken all these questions I've received. I got some on Twitter. I got a couple emailed. I got some on Facebook. And I'm trying to figure out which order to take these. And I've literally not looked at these since I took and I copied and pasted these into Evernote, which I use for my kind of when I'm gathering data for the shows, very handy tool. So I think we'll just go down the list here. And there's a couple here that are kind of similar, so I might jump around a bit and lump them in together. So here's the first question. This is from Hiro, and he asked me on Twitter, what is your must-have topping on a burger besides mayo, ketchup, or mustard? So besides the condiments, what do I have to absolutely have on a burger? I'm surprised he didn't say cheese excluded as well, because that's my first answer. It would be a cheese of some sort. I don't remember the last time I ate a hamburger without some sort of a cheese on it. And I think we actually went back and forth on Twitter a little bit about this, and I mentioned that blue cheese is one of my favorites on a burger. And there's actually a company here in Oregon called the Rogue Creamery down in Southern Oregon in Medford. And they make this, they make several different cheeses, but they make this one particular cheese that's called a smoky blue, an Oregon smoky blue cheese. And oh my God, it is so good. Even if you don't like blue cheese, because blue cheese can be kind of, well, sharp or pungent. A lot of people can't just eat blue cheese straight. This cheese is so smoky and creamy for blue cheese. You could just eat it plain. It is so good. And it's really, really good on a hamburger. Very clever company too. They have a great play on gorgonzola cheese, what they just call it, Oregonzola. So pretty clever. Rogue Creamery. So yeah, I would say cheese. And if it's not blue cheese, more often than not, I use cheddar or American cheese on my burger. So that's my answer for must-have toppings. So I have another question here that's kind of related to hamburgers. Seth Heasley sent me an email about hamburgers. I'm going to read a little bit of it here. All right. He says, hi, Roger. I've recently grown out of my childish insistence on well-done steaks moving towards medium rare. But one thing I just can't get behind is pink ground beef. From a food safety perspective, how is pink ground beef safe? Maybe you can help me get over my hang up on this. I always just go with an 80-20 ground beef, counting on the extra yummy fat to keep the burger moist, even and well done. By the way, if you've covered this on a show I haven't gotten to, let me know. Just listen to number 4 about food safety. And there was some general discussion. So this is a really good question. And it's fair to say, and I think I did mention this back in my episode number 4 on food safety, is you can't tell by vision, by looks, if the food you have in front of you is cooked to a safe temperature. Because you're right, sometimes food is completely cooked to a safe temperature and it looks still kind of raw. And that's the same way with hamburger. So you can have a pink hamburger that's cooked to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the minimum safe temperature you want to cook ground beef to, and it's still pink and it looks a little bit rare. Or you might have a hamburger that's no pink at all and it's still cooked to the minimum safe temperature of 160. On the other hand, you can have a hamburger that looks brown all the way through, but it's not cooked to a safe temperature of 160. So two-part answer here. So pink hamburger sometimes is safe to eat, but not because it's safe to eat undercooked hamburger. It just happens to be that the hamburger is actually cooked to a safe temperature and still looks pink. That's kind of a confusing answer. But for ground beef, you really want to use a food thermometer if you want to play it the absolute safest that you can. So if somebody says, oh, it's okay if you undercook your hamburgers a little bit and they're pink inside, they're still safe to eat. You know, most of the time, if it's undercooked a little, you probably will not get sick. But the thing with ground beef is that's different than like the steak that you mentioned, like a medium rare steak where it's not well done, is a steak, which is like a piece of muscle. When it's cut, any bacteria that's in the air that's around that can contaminate that meat will stay on the surface, okay? So when you cook a steak, you generally kill everything on the exterior of that steak. Well, the problem with ground beef is that when it's ground up, even if you take a piece of sirloin steak and grind it into hamburger, you're causing a problem because when you grind it, you're pushing the bacteria potentially into the hamburger that you're making. So with hamburger, you really do have to be careful and, you know, cook it as much as you can to a safe temperature, pink or not. Now, if you want to avoid the dry bit of hamburgers where they're just overdone, again, use a food thermometer and hit it right at 160, and they should still be generally moist, especially if you're using the 80-20% fat mix. Another trick you could do, if it's okay for you, is to mix in some ground pork into the hamburger. Maybe do like a 75% beef, 25% ground pork. It won't change the flavor all that much, but it might add a little more moistness to the ground beef and the burger patty, which isn't that crazy because a lot of times for meatloaf recipes or meatball recipes, you're doing a mixture of beef and pork. Hopefully that answers your question. So pink hamburgers may or may not be safe to eat. It just depends on if they're at 160 or higher. And that's really your minimum safe temperature for ground beef. When I was in high school, I worked at the local grocery store in the small town that I grew up in. And I was a courtesy clerk primarily. And what that means, and I don't even think they have these anymore, but what that means is when somebody would buy a cart full of groceries, they would call me up to the front and I would put them in bags and then I would take them out to the car. The customer or whatever. And of course, that was like 75% of my job, but I had to do all these other odd jobs like stocking, you know, the milk container in the cooler section or, you know, cleaning up or whatever. And for some reason, I was often tasked with cleaning the meat department. So, you know, this grocery store had a butcher department where they cut meat and did all that sort of stuff. You know, I was in high school at the time, but in retrospect, knowing how good of a cleaner I was, which probably really wasn't that good, I would be leery about not cooking ground beef to the minimum proper temperature, because I can remember cleaning the big meat grinder thing. I mean, it's like this giant steel bin the size of a Volkswagen Beetle with like a grinder thing that, you know, just this huge screw at the bottom. And I remember having to crawl in there and dig stuff out and clean it and bleach it and spray it down. And, you know, I'm a carnivore, I'm a meat eater, but you got to be careful when it comes to cooking, you know, hamburger and things like that to a safe temperature. Okay, I'm off that kick. Let's move on to the next question. Thank you, Seth. That was a good one. All right, here is three questions, actually, that came in on Twitter. And this was from, and forgive me, Jessica and or Liz. I'm not sure which one of you actually asked this question on Twitter. I'm not sure if you share that Twitter account or not. But from the Cocktails and Centaurs podcast, so three questions. first one is olive oil or coconut oil? And I assume that that was the question. Of course, Twitter has a character limit, so it was a short message. But I assume you mean which one is best to cook with. As far as I am concerned, olive oil is the way to go. It's a standard. It's very versatile. When you look at the health benefits between olive oil or coconut oil, and keep in mind, I am not a nutritionist. I'm not a dietitian. But, you know, olive oil has a lot less saturated fat, and it has a lot more of like the polyunsaturated fats and the good fats that you find in oil. So I think from a health standpoint, from what's known right now, olive oil is a good way to go. I don't know if coconut oil may be a bit of a fad or, you know, kind of the new hot thing. And as far as cooking goes, I think they're quite similar. They're both like a medium smoke point type of an oil, so you're not going to do any deep fat frying in them or anything like that. But for sautéing in that sort of a thing, they're quite similar. But I would go with olive oil. I think it's just kind of more standard and more versatile. You know, if you have olive oil and say like a neutral vegetable oil, like a canola oil or something in your house, that's probably really all you need. I mean, you're going to be able to do 95% of all the cooking you want to do, I think, with those two oils, at least the kind of cooking that I do. Your second question was best way to cook asparagus. And very subjective question. My favorite way to cook asparagus is to just take fresh asparagus, trim the bottom, you know, two-thirds of the asparagus with a vegetable peeler, just kind of peel off some of the stalk skin on the outside of the asparagus. I like to toss it in a little bit of olive oil. There's that olive oil again. And hit it with a good amount of sea salt, and then either throw it under the broiler on a broiler pan, you know, 500 degree broiler for maybe 5 minutes, or throw it on the grill and kind of do the same thing. Really, really hot direct heat for just a few minutes to kind of char it and grill it. And I think that's perfect. So that's my favorite way to cook asparagus. And then your third question is a good one. And this is controversial, I suppose, too. And it probably depends on where you're from. But your question is simply barbecue rub, barbecue sauce, or both. I belong to the both camp. So I love using barbecue rub as a beginning to your barbecue process. So let's say you're going to do ribs. And incidentally, I have a really great barbecue rub recipe if you go to kitchencounterpodcast.com/2. For my second episode, I actually did an episode on ribs. And in there, I link to my favorite barbecue rub recipe. Very versatile. It works on pork, chicken, beef. I use it on practically everything protein-wise that I put on a grill. So I like to rub ahead of time and then sauce at the very end. So just to kind of let it cook in slowly and then sauce at the end. Now, if you're going to do something like boiling your ribs, for example, then a barbecue rub is not going to work. It would just wash off, basically. But a rub is great if you're not doing any sort of wet cooking method. So I recommend both. All right, let's see. What else do we have? All right, I've got a couple here from BJ. And one of these might actually turn into a full episode, but I'll touch on it briefly. These came in on Facebook, and she asked about pressure cookers. She'd like me to talk about pressure cookers because they actually are a bit scary to her. And totally understandable. The whole concept of a pressure cooker where you put food into this steel container and clamp it down and then raise the pressure to a degree that it could become dangerous in your kitchen is kind of crazy. I mean, theoretically, a pressure cooker is kind of like a bomb. If you think about it, if you were to somehow make that pressure cooker so it couldn't release and regulate the pressure in it, it would eventually blow open somehow. But the good news is for pressure cookers that you use in a home kitchen, they're fairly safe. They have fail safes. They have a little pressure regulator. Most of them have a little weight that sits over a little spout, like on top of the pressure cooker. And as soon as the pressure of whatever you're cooking inside gets to a certain, I don't know if it's measured in PSI, I guess, that little weight will kind of lift up and release the pressure. So if you were to lift that little weight off that outlet completely, the pressure would just go way down and eventually disappear from the pressure cooker, and there's no safety issue. So I wouldn't worry about pressure cookers not being safe as long as you use them as they're directed and as the instructions show. I mean, when was the last time you heard of anyone's house exploding because they misused a pressure cooker? I can't even think of a time. So I don't think you should be scared of them. Now, I have a pressure cooker. I've used it for canning. I haven't really used it much for like cooking tough cuts of meat. So one advantage of a pressure cooker, for example, is you could cook a real a roast maybe that takes several hours of low moist heat to kind of break down the connective tissue and get really tender in the oven. You know, something that might take 3 hours in the oven might only take, you know, 45 minutes in a pressure cooker or something like that. So you can cook food a lot faster. I don't really use it for that myself. I don't really have much call to do that. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. It's just I don't have personally that much experience using a pressure cooker that way. But I have used them primarily for canning, for doing preserving vegetables or things like that. So I might turn this into an entire episode in the future. But for now, BJ, I wouldn't worry about pressure cookers being a safety concern as long as you follow the directions. And then BJ had a second question on cast iron. And this is a pretty big question as well, but I'm going to touch on it here. She wanted to know, how do you care for cast iron? What people cook in cast iron pans? And why would you want a cast iron pan versus a quote-unquote regular pan? Well, for some people, I'll answer that last question first. Regular pans might be cast iron pans. I talked a little bit about cast iron cookware. I think it was back in episode 20 for my Kitchen Essentials cooking equipment episode, where I talked about cast iron and stainless steel and aluminum cookware and so on and so forth. The primary reason cast iron is awesome is it's really durable and it holds heat amazingly well. So you can get cast iron pans meltingly hot. I mean, just as hot as you can imagine, probably the hottest piece of cookware in your kitchen, really. And it will stay hot. And you can transfer cast iron from the stovetop to the oven without worrying about ruining the cookware. So if you want to cook a steak inside and you want to get a really, really good sear on that steak, like cast iron is maybe the best way you can do that. For example, you get your cast iron skillet really screaming hot with a little oil, you sear that steak, and then you can pop that steak in the oven in the cast iron skillet and all and finish it off that way. So cast iron, very durable, very heavy. So if you are planning on doing things like moving it from the stovetop to the oven, just know that a cast iron pan is probably going to be the heaviest thing in your kitchen, and they're not necessarily easy to wield and move around. But people, you can cook anything in a cast iron pan. In a cast iron pan that's been seasoned well and cared for carefully, I wouldn't say is as nonstick as Teflon. I don't think there's anything as nonstick as Teflon, but it can get pretty darn close. So you can cook omelets and eggs and things like that in a well-seasoned cast iron pan. I say for cast iron, anything you really want hot, even not necessarily even heating, but hot heat that holds it and is very durable is the way to go. Now, caring for cast iron is a little more tricky than some other cookware materials. You can't put cast iron in your dishwasher. And in fact, if you have, I would say, pots and pans that are of any sort of quality, I wouldn't put them in the dishwasher. I would wash everything you can that in the pots and pan department by hand if you can swing it. You know, cast iron, when you season a cast iron pan, it basically means you're baking in oil into the pores of that metal. It's like it's not that the oil just kind of seeps in. It actually changes the chemical composition of that oil. So it creates a barrier between the cast iron material and whatever food you're cooking in it. So the oil actually creates a barrier, kind of makes it nonstick. You also typically, as a general rule, don't want to use soap to clean your cast iron pan because you could potentially wear away some of that seasoning or chip off some of that seasoning. Not really likely. It's a bit of a wives tale that you can't use a little bit of soap in cast iron cookware to clean it. It's not really going to hurt it. What you don't want to do is take a scouring pad
or really get in there and scrub on it. If you have, you know, baked on food in a cast iron skillet, the best thing to do really is get some hot water into it as soon as you can and try to get it out that way. If it won't come out, you can use a little coarse kosher salt. You can sprinkle into the bottom of your pan and use that to kind of scrub off whatever you've got cooked on in there, and that will generally take care of it. But then you just wipe it out and put it in your cupboard, and you just kind of build up this almost this patina of seasoning use after use. And even if you did ruin the seasoning on it somehow, you can always re-season a pan just by simply rubbing it down with oil and throwing it into like a 350-degree oven for a couple of hours. So, you know, cast iron, again, I think having a cast iron skillet isn't the worst thing you can have in your kitchen. But again, I think for me, at least, I really prefer stainless steel now. I think I'm kind of going in that direction. It can get just as hot almost as cast iron. It's quite versatile. It's easy to care for, and it looks really good too. So those are my thoughts on cast iron. And so don't be afraid of using it. And if you have any more specific questions, let me know. Oh, and I think I might have mentioned in a past episode too, in that cookware episode, that I have a couple pieces of enameled cast iron cookware, like Le Creuset Dutch ovens. I mean, if I had to pick three things in my kitchen that I would drag out if the house was on fire, my Le Creuset Dutch oven would definitely be one of them. I cook so much stuff in that thing. So that's my Le Creuset plug. Let's see here. We have... So this question came from JD at In Session Film, and he said, what recipe surprised you the most? Wow, that was a really good question, and I remember getting it and thinking about it. And I guess there's so many different ways to answer a question like that. Like, surprising, I guess the way I interpreted that question was, in my own mind at least, like, what recipe did I learn for something I liked to eat that surprised me and how easy it was. That's how I interpreted this question. And even trying to think of it in different ways, the one thing I always keep coming back to, I've been thinking about this one for a few days, is I keep coming back to cheesecake. Now, I've said before on the show in past episodes, I'm not the baker of the family. My wife does most of the baking, is really an exceptional baker. I'm not so much. But a long time ago, I was trying to impress somebody probably. And I thought, I'm going to make a cheesecake. I never had made one before. I looked up some recipes. I figured it out. And I was actually shocked. It turned out really good. And it might have been the first thing I ever baked that turned out any good at all. And it turned out really good. And what surprised me the most about it is it seems like such an exotic, such a difficult thing to make. People always, if they like cheesecake, they're always oohing and aahing about cheesecake and how amazing it is. If you can make a cheesecake, you will get on so many people's good list so quickly, and you will be amazingly impressive to them. And I'm telling you what, cheesecakes are not that hard to make. The hardest thing about cheesecakes, honestly, is getting the right pan. You just need to have a springform pan, which is like a metal pan that's a ring that releases from the bottom of the pan. So it's like a removable bottom. So when you bake your cheesecake, you pop the ring off the side, and you're left with this nice round cheesecake on this little metal sheet. That's really the hardest thing about a cheesecake, I think. And in the show notes for this episode, kitchencounterpodcast.com/30, I will link to my favorite cheesecake recipe. It's an all recipes recipe. It's got like a bajillion 5-star reviews. It really is, I think, the best cheesecake recipe out there. And so cheesecake surprised me the most. I thought that would just be this most difficult baking, you know, all day in the kitchen. And it's really not that hard. All right, JD, thank you for that question. Let's see. Dave Meyer asks, what is the best way to make lettuce last in the fridge? Wow, this is a really, really good question. We've probably all been there. We go to the store, we find this beautiful bunch of, say, red leaf lettuce, fresh, crisp, vibrant. You throw it in a bag, you get it home, you put it in your crisper, and then a couple of days later, you're going to make your salad or whatever it is, and the lettuce is slimy, and it's like rotting in the bag, or it's all wilted, and it's like, wow, I mean, you don't even get any time at all out of it. I will tell you the magic trick to making lettuce last at home, and you have to have a special piece of equipment that's inexpensive, but if you eat salads, if you, you know, I'm assuming you somehow consume a lot of lettuce, Dave, because you're asking about this, you have to get a salad spinner. And before, long, long ago, before I ever even knew what a salad spinner was, I thought, why the heck would I need something that spins a salad around, is like mixes it up or something? Well, that's not what a salad spinner does. A salad spinner is basically made to remove liquid from your salad greens. I'll tell you what we do at my house. When we buy lettuce, the first thing I do when we get back from the market with that lettuce is I take the salad spinner out. I wash the heck out of that lettuce. I immerse it in icy cold water. I give it, you know, I really rough it up. I want to get all the crap out of it. I get it nice and clean, and then I throw it in batches, depending on how much lettuce I've got, into that salad spinner. And, it's, you know, most salad spinners have like a big press lever or a button or whatever, or a handle that makes everything inside spin, and the centrifugal force will just pull the water away from the lettuce or whatever greens you have in there. And you'll actually be shocked at how much water comes off your lettuce. And you can do it a couple of times and you'll still get a bunch of water off. And what you're going to end up with, though, is lettuce that's clean and pretty much dry. And then you take that lettuce and then you store it in a container in your fridge. So maybe you have like a nice plastic Tupperware container with a lid. If you want, you can throw in a couple of folded up paper towels in the bottom to soak up any moisture that might be left in there that might drip off the lettuce. But you put that in the fridge and you'll have lettuce that will last you a good week, at least, in the fridge. So, you know, a lot of times we'll plan a salad or we'll have other things that we're using lettuce for, and we get a nice big head or two of it, and we'll just get it on. We do our shopping on one day of the week and we'll have it all week. So definitely a salad spinner. And take care of your lettuce right when you get it home, and it will last a long time. Okay, got a couple more questions here. So this one I'm actually going to turn in also to a full episode, because this was a really good suggestion. And I don't think, this was from Roy McMillan, I don't think, Roy, you meant this to be just a question on my Q&A show, but I want to bring it up, to let you know I'm going to turn it into a full episode in the future. And just to give my thoughts on it. And you talked about last minute meals. So like on weeknights, you know, you're busy with the family. You don't have a lot of time to cook. What can you whip together in 30 minutes? And kind of what should you have on hand to be able to do that? I'm trying to remember. I talked about my wife was on the show and we talked about pantry items in one of our Kitchen Essentials shows. I think it was number 22, episode 22. We didn't specifically frame it in like, what can we cook with these items in 30 minutes or whatever, but there's some thoughts in there. But you mentioned like having a jar of pasta sauce and pasta on hand. Certainly that's definitely something if you've got a family and you don't have much time to cook and you need to put things together quickly, pasta and pasta sauce is always a hit. I say always have a carton of eggs in the fridge, because eggs, which I'm also, by the way, I promised to do this. I'm going to be doing an episode on eggs here in the near future too. Eggs are probably the most versatile thing in your kitchen. I mean, you can boil them, scramble them, fry them, make omelets, bake with them. I mean, you can make a meal out of eggs and whatever you have in the fridge, I think. So that's another vote of mine for what to have ready right away. And depending on what your philosophy is on food, I know some people would, God forbid, ever eat anything that came out of a can, or at least they would tell you that, and then they probably have a cupboard full of, you know, canned green beans or whatever. But, you know, if you don't mind eating things that come in a can, you know, having like canned chicken breast on hand is great, because that's an easy protein you can do a lot of stuff with. You can make wraps with it. You can throw it in some rice, you know, with some chicken stock, and you've got a meal. So there's a lot of things like that I would recommend too, that you just kind of have on hand for last minute meals. But I am going to do a full episode on that topic, because I think like the 30 minute meal thing, even though I think Rachel Ray probably has that trademarked, and I'll probably get a letter from her people because I'm sure they listen to my show. I'm going to turn that into an episode. That's a really good question. So thanks, Roy, for sending that in. Okay, two questions left. Wait, is that right? Let me look here. Two questions left, and these are both from Bree. And she had actually two really good questions, and these are questions when she sent them to me, I've actually put a lot of thought into, because they're nice questions. So first thing she asked was, what does my family usually eat during the holidays? And gosh, it's like, wow, it made me think about, I thought, well, Brie probably means Thanksgiving and or Christmas. But then I got to thinking about all these other holidays that, you know, you might, or I, at least I do, get together with a larger or smaller groups of family members to eat, like 4th of July, you know, let's barbecue, of course, on 4th of July. But I think, Brie, you probably meant like the holidays. So Thanksgiving, of course, we eat turkey and then all the trimmings, you know, stuffing and green bean casserole and sweet potatoes and all that. And then for Christmas time, you know, when I grew up, and this kind of is a segue into your other question, but when I grew up on Christmas Eve, we used to do kind of this almost like a potluck where we would just kind of put out food and the family would come over and we'd all just kind of munch and eat all night. And we always, on Christmas Eve is the night that we opened our presents, when I was growing up at least. So it was kind of like a, just get together with family, have fun, have food. And then the next day we would have a Christmas ham. So in recent years, my side of the family, we've been holding Christmas at my house, which is a lot of work, but a lot of fun. And I've started kind of a tradition of a Christmas ham and also some sort of a beef roast. So we'll do, like last year I did a New York roast, which is basically the cut of meat that you get New York steaks from, except it's in roast form. So imagine like 12 New York steaks connected in one, you know, giant hunk of meat. Really, really good and always a huge hit. So that's kind of my tradition is a ham and then some sort of a beef roast. And of course, all the traditional, you know, fixings that go along with it. And then Brie, your second question, which is what was my favorite food as a kid? You said that your mom or grandma or dad or other person made when I was a kid. That's almost an impossible question to answer because there's so much that when, you know, off the top of my head, I came up with an answer when I just thought about this when you sent it in. But then I, probably for the last week or however long it's been since you sent me that question, I've been thinking like, oh my gosh, what about this or that or all of these other things that I remember that I dearly miss eating, you know, that I had as a kid. That in some cases I've, you know, gotten my mom's recipe or whatever and try to make, you know, nothing's ever the same though when you do it like that, no matter how similar it is, it's just not the same. But I have two answers. And one, and this is something we always had at holidays, but my family is from the Midwest. So my parents are from South Dakota. I was born in Oregon. So my family moved to Oregon. I was born here. So I'm not necessarily from the Midwest, but because my parents and a lot of the rest of my family were, we are meat and potatoes people. So my mom would make probably five nights a week some sort of a meat and some sort of a potato dish with a vegetable for dinner. And my absolute favorite thing that she would make were mashed potatoes and gravy. And I could eat buckets of it, and I probably still could. I dearly, dearly miss my mom's mashed potatoes. And then my dad, I remember growing up, my dad, whenever we'd get a hold of a salmon, whether it was something he went fishing for and caught or friends of ours brought to us or even, you know, something we bought at the local market. And when I grew up, I mean, salmon, there were probably a lot more of them in the wild and around, but it wasn't something that we had all that often. It was really a treat. It's not like today when you can go to a store and, you know, the fish counter has five different types of salmon, farm raised, wild or whatever. When a salmon came through our small town, it was kind of a special thing. So we'd get it. We'd end up with the salmon, but my dad would smoke it. And I remember he built this smoker box, I guess out of plywood, and it was painted this, I don't know, weird like mint green color. I can see it in my mind. And it was always such an event and a special occasion because I remember helping him, you know, prepare the salmon the day before. We'd break down the fish. We'd brine the salmon. We cut it into chunks and brine it, you know, in a salt and sugar mixture all night. And then I remember we would get up super, super early, you know, before the sun was up, and he'd have the smoker box set up in a special spot down by the shop. And we would put the salmon in and we'd smoke it, and it would smoke for, I felt like forever, for hours. But when it was done, we had smoked salmon. And, you know, in retrospect, it wasn't superb smoked salmon. It was bony. It was salty. It was very smoky. It was kind of dry, but it's still my all-time favorite smoked salmon because it was a special occasion thing, and it was kind of an event, and it was fun to make. It was just kind of a special thing. So, you know, the things that I remember growing up that were my favorite things were kind of those special occasion sort of events around, you know, what we made and what we had for dinner. So thank you so much. That was a really, really good question. All right. So that was my batch of questions for my Q&A show for episode number 30. Thanks. I asked for questions. People sent them in. I really, really appreciate it. That was a lot of fun. Hopefully you found it interesting too. If you didn't, let me know, and I won't do Q&A shows like this in the future. I'll just take questions as they come in, you know, show by show. But I really had fun. So I appreciate everyone who sent me a question. And if you do have any more, if you want me to answer in future episodes, remember feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. Well, everybody, that does it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Thanks again for listening and listening this far into the show. And just like always, I want to let you know that if you like the show and you want to help out the show, I'm never going to ask you for your money. I don't want to sell you anything. But if you headed over to iTunes and left me a review and a rating, that would be great. That would be an easy way to help out the show. Or you can do that on Stitcher or wherever you consume your fine podcast material. And again, feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. If you want to email me, you can find me on Twitter at TKC Podcasts or Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. If you send me a question or if you engage me out on social media, I promise I will respond. I don't ignore anybody. And we usually end up having fun little conversations. So thanks again. I appreciate everything you do to help me in my show. And until next time, I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.